This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guest on Off the Shelf is John Etherton of Etherton & Associates. And John is a regular guest on the show, and it's always great to get his insights on what's going on the Hill with regard to the NDAAs and procurement policy and that sort of thing, and the budget and where things are going. John spent 18 years, is that right, John, on the Hill, and knows of what he speaks. So, John, welcome to the show. Great to have you back.
Thanks, Roger. It's great to be here.
Well, I'm looking forward to our conversation. And you know, with you, John, it's not hard. I'm just going to open it up and say, okay, John, what's going on with the NDAA right now and the budget process? I know it's going to be an interesting discussion.
Well, first, for those folks in the audience who may not be so keen on all the acronyms, the NDAA is the National Defense Authorization Bills, which the Senate and House Armed Services Committees put together every year. We're in kind of an interesting process this year. We have now, as a result of the Budget Reform Act agreements last December, an agreement on the top line numbers for defense for this year, as well as for the domestic discretionary spending. So the types of issues that divided us last year or divided the Congress aren't there. So everybody's working with the same numbers. So that's moved things along a little bit, and I think has made the process somewhat more predictable. We did have to wait till last couple weeks to get the administration's request for overseas contingency operations, and that wasn't sent over fast enough for either House or Senate Armed Services Committee to actually look over any of that. Although now that they have the numbers, I expect if the Senate has a crack at floor time at some point, why they will definitely try to rework those numbers. But we're in a position now where both committees have finished work on their bills. The bill is passed on the House side, so it's done essentially, and they're waiting now for the Senate, which reported its bill on June the 2nd. To try to get some floor time and to take the bills up. In my world this year, what's interesting about the process is that both the House and Senate have essentially told us, we in the public and industry, as well as the members in Congress, that they really are going to look at reforming or transforming or improving, or whatever term you want to use, the acquisition process as a major one of their issues next year. And this is coming from both the Senate Armed Services Committee as well as the House Armed Services Committee. And so the idea this year, I think, for both committees was that they didn't want to try any major initiatives and put them in the bill, but really clear a space so that some issues can be addressed next year. Notwithstanding that, I think if you look at the content of both the House and the Senate bills, what you see is, you know, several fairly significant efforts in different directions. They're different in each bill between the House and the Senate, but I think in the House side, there are a number of provisions which collectively, I think, continue to raise concerns about the degree to which the Department of Defense is relying on contractors to perform services. There was a cut of about $800 million in the operations and maintenance accounts the House Armed Services Committee took, which essentially was for contracted services as a reduction to try to pay some of the bills for other things that they wanted to do. There also is some language in there about the cap that currently exists on the total expenditures for contract services in the Department of Defense to try to keep that at the same level as was the case in fiscal year 10.
So, John, they
want to extend that for another year into a fiscal year 2015.
So the cap and the $800 million cut.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's the thinking there? Are those presumably those services either go away, which they may be supporting, you know, mission. I mean, obviously supporting mission that's being accomplished, you know, whatever it is. It could be it could be office support of some sort of IT. You know, so the need isn't necessarily going to go away, and the government's not going to perform those things. How does this work?
I think, first of all, that the committee needed money to move into different priority things that they wanted to do that were not covered in the budget request. So I think that was a motivating factor. I think the other factor that folks were looking at, people on the House side, I have heard some skepticism about the degree to which the Department of Defense is actually managing their contracted services spending in total below the FY10 cap, which has been in place now for the last 3 or 4 years. And I suspect that this $800 million cut, which in the greater scheme of the operations and maintenance accounts, is not a big percentage. It's mm-hmm. relatively small, and it wasn't taken out of any one account. They sort of took it out of salami sliced out of a number of accounts. I think that, to me, that was sort of a signal that they felt that the department, probably their spend was a little bit higher than what they were tracking, and they wanted to ensure that the department was, in fact, keeping below the caps as they made these other decisions and freed up money for other things.
Okay. And go ahead. I interrupted you.
Oh. So I think that's one of the major themes that emerges from the House Armed Services Bill. Another thing I just wanted to mention was the continuing interest in information technology acquisition and changes that might be made to that. There are two provisions in the House bill, or two clusters of provisions, one of which deals with trying to get a more sort of enterprise view of information technology investments and setting up a process to do that. That's section 1004 in the bill. And then on the floor of the House, during floor consideration in May, the House agreed to continue or added in a version of the Federal Information Technology Acquisition Reform Act, which was added last year on the floor. It's a slightly different version this year, pared back on a couple of provisions. But I think there's still this broader interest in government-wide transformation of IT acquisition principles and some sort of more central management of that whole enterprise. And so I think we're getting ready to have that discussion again. So sort of parenthetically, on the Senate side, in the Homeland Security Governmental Affairs Committee, a couple of weeks ago, they marked up their own version of the Federal Information Technology Acquisition Reform Act, which we call FITARA. And so there's a great likelihood, again, if the Senate National Defense Bill gets to the floor, that there'll be an attempt on both the House and Senate side to include this language in the bill. And we'll just sort of see where that goes. I think on the Senate side, in the Senate version of the bill, there's a much more comprehensive approach to information technology transformation in terms of the acquisition process. There were a number of cuts taken to specific programs that were done in the bill. And at the same time, the committee puts several sections in Title VIII of the bill directing such initiatives as using essentially migrating the current DoD programs, as well as the ones that are about ready to emerge, to a more open system approach, and so that the programs can be more easily integrated and not rely on proprietary technology to the same extent. A lot of debate about that language, pro and con, not so much about the goal, but about how practical that language is in the current environment. And a number of other things dealing with cyber penetration. There's language in Title 16 of the bill, and some other general management approaches in Title 8 on information technology, that I would characterize that as a major initiative coming out of the Senate Armed Services Committee. And if that is combined with the Federal Information Technology Acquisition Reform Act on the floor, could be a fairly robust package of changes to the acquisition process, not only in the Department of Defense, but in federal agencies, at a time when people have basically said they don't intend to do much this year. So there's actually more a little bit below the curtain than would be obvious by a cursory reading of the bills.
Yeah. Well, when you mentioned a more centralized approach, are we seeing something that's not necessarily the same as the old GSA, Management of Information Technology, or are there echoes of this, in that?
I think we're seeing echoes of it, and it's an interesting conversation to have now, given the state of the technology. Back in the day when we originally had the Brooks Act and more central GSA management of what was automated data processing, or ADP.
I haven't heard that term in a long time.
That's been a while, right?
That dates us, doesn't it?
It does a little bit. But I think that the thinking then was that primarily the IT resources that agencies were buying or acquiring services through were mainframe computers.
Right.
And so the idea that you had a central organization that would look at, and I don't know to what extent the mainframes at the time were customized or whether they were mainly sort of large systems that were largely commodity type purchases for relatively narrow sets of functions. But having more central, you could at least understand the logic for that. Then we went more to network sort of centric approaches and desktop computers and those sorts of things. And now we seem to be moving back to somewhat more looking at systems sort of as an end-to-end backbone proposition. And so maybe that's an interesting analogy with the old ADP mainframe. And maybe that's what is driving people to look at this more as perhaps a problem of centrality in terms of the various agency systems being able to talk to one another across the government. As you try this more government enterprise view of management, maybe that's one of the underlying factors that's driving this conversation.
Okay, and I, John, we do have to take a break, but when we come back, we'll be talking more to John Etherton of Etherton & Associates. And when we come back, I got a follow-up question just about the convergence of IT and services and where that's going. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is John Etherton of Etherton & Associates. And John, when we took the break, we were talking about efforts on the Hill to reform IT acquisition and what's going on there and this issue of centralization versus not and the way technology has changed. One thing I wanted to get a better feeling for is, there is a lot there. As you mentioned in the first segment, a lot of churn, a lot of things going on, whether Fatera and other pieces that, if you take it collectively, it could be a sea change in IT acquisition to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. What sort of driving it? I mean, is it, I think of things like healthcare.gov. I think of things like people seeing the convergence of IT and services and cloud space and those type of things, and whether the government's taking advantage of, new technologies and new capabilities that are out in the private marketplace, and just the government just can't seem to get its hands around it. Is that what's driving it, or what is driving it?
I think those factors are all things that are driving it. I mean, I look at a couple of different issues. I think on the one hand, you see, and I think there was recognition, especially in OMB, that the private sector was delivering IT in different ways than perhaps the government had been, looking or seriously considering. I mean, things like software as a service, this whole service model for IT, especially for things that people are regarding more and more as commodity type purchases, and that the system and the government really was not geared toward that, or they're really not open to that. I think the other issue, health.gov issue was a huge one, and I think that still lingers. Although people aren't talking about it as much, it certainly gave impetus to a lot of this. But keep in mind, for example, the Federal Information Technology Acquisition Reform Act, FITARA, actually predated health.gov. I mean,
that's true.
That was a process started a couple of years even before that. I think the other issue that is, we haven't...
I guess folks could say, I told you so, we need that.
Yeah, to the extent you can map the issues from one to the other, which I think is a tricky enterprise.
Yes. Yep.
But I think that the other thing that we have a lot of information now and a lot of experience for the Department of Defense and other agencies buying large business process systems or whatever, with at best very mixed success. And I think some of the lessons from that process are starting to emerge. We just, for example, this couple days ago, the Senate Homeland Security Governmental Affairs Committee, a permanent subcommittee on investigations, released their report on the Air Force's ECSS program, which is on their website, and Senator McCain, I think at least, and there may be of others, have given floor statements with their view on that. But I think the idea of, we're now starting to really see significant patterns in the way that the government has been acquiring these systems and the way they've been trying to integrate the systems with the business processes within the agencies, and with very, very, at best, very mixed success. And so I think people are starting to focus on those things now and trying to extract lessons learned and trying to figure out what can be done to foster better practices and sort of set up sort of more virtuous circles to get better outcomes. And so I think that's also driving a lot of it. And I also think there's a general recognition that the importance of good, solid IT systems for basically managing very complex government enterprises. Right. And I think more and more people are really seeing that as becoming, especially as we cut back on the budgets and things like that, where we're going to be relying more on these kinds of systems to do things where we may have had paper and people doing before. I think people are really seeing that as a lot of promise. And if the government does not have effective ways of acquiring those capabilities, we're going to be in a world of hurt. I think, and that's where, so I think that's all of that is driving, and I think this is really emerging as a big area right now.
Yeah, well, you know, I just think about it, my time in government, information is, you know, I guess, is, you know, it's the lifeblood of a of any organization, you know, in the 21st century, but the government, especially, just the amount of information that people have to process, that you handle each day to make decisions on, you know, operational issues or policy issues or just that affect the entire country. You,
right.
You could see that, you know, having better systems could make a huge difference.
Right, right.
But along those lines, one thing I wanted to ask you too is sort of a philosophical question, or maybe it's not philosophical, maybe it's more practical. And that is, there's all this action, you know, now or a focus on it on the Hill with regard to IT acquisition. And I guess, you know, the practical side of me wants to say it couldn't most of the stuff be done, you know, by the executive branch as part of its management function. I mean, as someone who worked in the executive branch.
I think the answer is absolutely. I mean, you have the rare cases where there may be a statute in place or a budget requirement or whatever, which acts as a significant obstacle to better management practice. But frankly, that's what I put in the category of low-hanging fruit, and most of that's been plucked, you know,
sure,
for a long time. I think that a lot of what we're seeing with IT is Congress really trying to better understand what its appropriate oversight role is. And a lot of the legislation that you see, and some of it's quite lengthy, is as much a sort of setting a better baseline for oversight than it is actually necessary for directing the agencies to do this, that, or the other. Because if you read the legislation, generally it's drafted in a way that there may be certain requirements, there may be certifications. I think we're certificationing the process to death, you know, in some ways. But in each of those cases, almost in every case, there's a waiver and there's some ability to document a different course of action. And so it puts, I think, in many cases, a significant burden on the agencies to sort of conform to this process that Congress has laid out, and not always to the best effect. But I do think that Congress sees this as a way for laying a better foundation for continuing oversight, rather than with an expectation that by simply legislative fiat, they're going to affect an immediate change in the executive branch enterprise.
Right. So another question that just popped in my head, and just thinking about it, if you want to have better IT systems to support the federal government, does that, and this is sort of an off-wall question, I guess, or it's something we haven't really talked about.
Or maybe an off-the-shelf question.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. Thank you very much. I'll remember that. You know, just the issue of, you know, systems versus organizational structure.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, do you see any, I mean, I know there's been, I think the administration has tried to look at government organization in the past. Is there any, you know, interest in how parts of the government organize to make it more efficient, or is it really just about everybody has their turf and there's committees that have oversight over particular parts of agencies, even not just entire, you know, departments or departments within departments or agencies, that sort of creates a situation that maybe IT is the only way we can get some of these efficiencies versus organizationally?
I think the experience that we've had in the past with trying to use IT to leverage business processes, for example, even within an agency, have not been terribly compelling as a sort of a way to do things. I think that, and that's been one of the issues, obviously, that and I see it especially in the Department of Defense, but in other agencies as well, is the difficulty of using sort of, you know, commercial approaches or private sector approaches for business process reengineering, importing those into the government with the government structure, and frankly, the different imperatives that the agencies have and what they do versus what a private sector organization will do. But then how do you adapt and sort of change those things? In my view, the answer has tended to be more on the customization side rather than actually using that. Because I don't think you have change management often at the very highest levels in the government. And given the broad span of control that agency leaders have, to actually get a lot of attention focused on actually driving internal organizational change based on a business process, IT system investment or something like that. I think it's going to take more, if people are truly interested in better integration of the agencies within agencies and a more efficient business process within the agencies, it will take more than simply importing technology from the outside and using that as a forcing function. I think that's one of the lessons that I derived from the last 4 or 5 years of experience.
Okay. And John, we do have to take our next break. When we come back, we'll be talking more to John Etherton of Etherton & Associates. And when we come back, I'm going to ask him to give some insights on some of the amendments. I guess there's a large number of them, or relatively large number, out there with the National Defense Authorization Act. And then we'll turn our attention to some of John's efforts in working on acquisition reform initiatives. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is John Etherton of Etherton & Associates, and we've been talking about, you know, the National Defense Authorization Act. We've been talking about, you know, prospects for IT acquisition reform, or at least what's going on in that area and what some of that looks like. And now I wanted to continue the conversation and just get your insights or take on some of the various amendments to the NDAA that have been offered already, and I guess the timing of those amendments.
Sure. As I indicated earlier, the Senate Armed Services Committee reported out their version of the National Defense Authorization Act in June. And they've had a real struggle over the last 5 years, really, getting the bill to the floor, and other than sort of end-of-the-year extreme circumstances, and then had even more difficulty, especially the last 2 or 3 years, getting the bill off the floor once they start the debate and start adding amendments, and have had to cobble together with the House, their House counterparts, sort of these unusual processes to actually get a conference report done. Normally what happens in the Senate is that when it looks like the bill is about ready to get to the floor, you will have the members suddenly start to file their amendments. They're not required to do so under Senate rules, but they'll file the amendments just so that they can have the baseline for trying to start negotiations with the staff, maybe get the committees to agree to various things. The prospects for, frankly, right now, getting the National Defense Authorization Act on the floor in the Senate anytime before the election, I think, are pretty slim. At least that's the conventional wisdom. Certainly not in the month of July. And so some of us have been a little surprised, even though the committee did put out a call for members to start pulling their amendments together and sending them in, and they set various deadlines. We did not really expect to see much or anything until much later in the fall. And lo and behold, if you start checking the congressional record and looking at the amendment lists, starting mid-June, we started to see amendments being filed on this bill. And right now, at least as of Monday, the 7th, close of business, there were 62 amendments that had been filed on the authorization bill, some of which are acquisition policy-related amendments. There were actually one with Senator Levin dealing with cyber and cyber reporting and protection and some additional things there, which I think Senator Levin, and this is his last year as chairman and last year in the Senate, will assign a very high importance to and priority to. And there were a number of other provisions in there dealing with small business, people picking up provisions that were already in the House bill that they thought, if they can get them in the Senate bill, will assure that they would be passed in a specific form. I think it's interesting that the dynamic has already started and people are looking now to try to lay markers down in terms of positions and policies of things that they want to see in a bill that may not see the floor until mid-November. Which tells me there's a lot of energy around a lot of this, and it'll be interesting to see sort of where all that goes.
Are there any amendments? I mean, you mentioned the cyber. Are there any other amendments that are of particular interest to, that you've had a chance to take a look at?
The ones that I've taken a look at, again, I haven't seen anything that I would consider to be earth-shattering. I think the cyber amendment, the Levin amendment that's in there, and I think it's number 7 on the list, is the one that that I thought was the most interesting, and because it seems to follow a course or a pattern that Chairman Levin has been interested in now for the last several years. There actually is a section already in the authorization bill, section 1645, which lays out, you know, the department's responsibilities to improve their reporting of cyber incidents in the contractors world. And so it was interesting to me that they're sort of already laying those kinds of things out there. I didn't see anything else coming from outside the committee that I think is particularly worrisome or noteworthy. A lot of it, amendments there were things that have already appeared in the House bill, and that if they were introduced and adopted in the Senate, would essentially lock them in as something that would be in the final bill. But again, I think it's just worth noting that these things are now starting to happen much earlier than we would normally have expected, and that I expect over the course of the summer we'll continue to see that list grow.
Yeah, and just in terms of that cyber amendment, I guess it strikes me that there's a lot going on in that space. Mm-hmm. And is it a situation where people, you know, think of something new to add to the requirements that DoD faces, or is there a comprehensive sort of look at what's already being required of the department or of the federal government, comparing that to what people think ought to be done and trying to fill those gaps in a comprehensive way? Or is it just, here's another idea? How does it work?
I can only speak from what I know about the Senate process, and I think it really is a result of thorough research and investigation. Yeah. I mean, the Senate investigation staff who were on the Senate Armed Services Committee did a fairly extensive investigation last summer. And it's my understanding that there will actually be an unclassified report that we can expect them to release at some point in the next month or so, in which they went out and actually tried to understand incidents of penetration or other kinds of things, and how well that information was being captured, what was the complete realm of contractor activity which were covered by those attempts, and how much of it was reported in a timely way, what everybody's understanding was of the reporting responsibilities and that sort of thing. So I think these aren't things that people sit in their offices and make up. I think they actually went down and really did, you know, some fairly thorough investigations and you know, talked to a number of different companies and got very specific information. And so I think it is driven by a lot of that and a lot of concern that the reporting requirements may not be as well understood as they should be. The realm of the incidents that need to be reported, the nature of those, whether it's a prime contractor situation where you have a penetration in their system versus a subcontractor, and to what extent the full subcontractor's organization should be covered versus maybe only the part of the organization that's working as a subcontract under contract. I mean, there are a number of those kinds of issues where I think people are quite concerned. And I think it's not necessarily that there's some necessarily, at least recently, a large smoking gun of something that's happened, but I think it's just the fact that perhaps we don't know, and there are gaps in terms of what people's understanding of their responsibilities are. So I think I see that driving a lot of this activity, but it's based on empirical information, not theory or intuition.
Right. Well, I think that's important. I think it's good to hear that. I mean, it's important that people understand that, you know, this isn't a willy-nilly exercise, right? That there's a lot of thought that goes into, I mean, a very challenging area that, you know, we all have to deal with, right?
Right.
So, John, I wanted to start to turn, we got just a couple minutes left in this segment, and we got one more segment to go, but I want to start a conversation or a discussion of what you're doing at the National Defense Industrial Association. You are a senior fellow there.
Mm-hmm.
You're working on an acquisition reform initiative.
Project, whatever,
the right title. You give me the right title.
Yeah,
that's
fine. That's fine.
So what is that?
A couple months ago, at the end of March, the majority-minority leadership of the House and Senate Armed Services Committee jointly sent a letter to several, among other groups, several trade associations, asking for their inputs on how to improve the acquisition process and embark on serious reform. The National Defense Industrial Association received one of those letters, and they came and asked me if I would be willing to serve on a volunteer basis as senior fellow for acquisition reform and oversee that process. So we are working away at that process. The first milestone for the inputs that they asked folks to provide is July the 10th. And the companies, we've been working, and we have provided an interim response to the committees, but we told them that at the time they made the initial request, that frankly just a couple of months was not enough time, in our view, to really develop meaningful input in the way that we would be happiest. So what we are doing is working through a process over the summer that in our target date for our final input is probably the middle to latter part of September. And what we have done is essentially the National Defense Industrial Association is a 1,600-member organization, so it's a very broad sort of grassroots group that represents every segment of industry, from small to large business, as well as people that sell services and every kind of good in the department. So trying to sort of wrestle with that size and complexity of that membership to try to get inputs from folks, and then we have to sort of organize that information in ways that the Hill would find meaningful. We're right in the middle of that process now. What I would say to anyone who's interested in what we're doing and the way we're looking at the issues, we have taken a very strong view on transparency in this process, and we're posting all of our materials, including the transcripts from the meetings that we've held. We've had one so far. The next one is on July the 29th. Those transcripts without the attribution in most cases are at least being posted so people can actually see how we're proceeding, what our timelines are, the way we've bucketed the issues. And we welcome any inputs. I personally do, and I think the organization, and welcome participation of anyone in the process.
Right. Well, thanks, John. And we do. Sure. That's perfect break right there. We do have to take our last break. My guest today is John Etherton of Etherton Associates, and when we come back, we'll continue the conversation about the effort with the National Defense Industrial Association, and talk also a little bit about some recent testimony John made before the Senate Armed Services Committee. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is John Etherton of Etherton Associates, and we've been talking about goings-ons on the Hill, if I said that correctly, and in terms of acquisition, the NDAA, and John is also now working on a volunteer basis as a senior fellow for the National Defense Industrial Association, working on a acquisition reform project? Yeah, is that a fair way to describe it?
Exactly. That's the official description.
Yes. Okay, very good. But, you know, those things come and go, don't they, John? Right. So what is going to be different this time? You know, things that we've actually worked together on in the past, and is this time going to be different? What do you think? Are you optimistic?
I'm hopeful. I guess we have a lot of reason for optimism yet, but I'm always hopeful.
Keep hope alive, right?
That's right. No, I think that we have a couple things that are at play now that were not at play in some of the earlier efforts that could make this more of an effective exercise than what we've had in the past. And we, you know, let's face it, the things that we've done, you and I have been involved in together, and frankly, over the last 30 years, a number of different efforts, they were at least partially successful in moving the process in a certain direction, although there is a sense that there always seems to be all these conditions that sort of drive it back into a certain equilibrium. And so the question is, what will be different this time? I think two things. Number one, I think we have systems, as we talked earlier, on the IT side for capturing information and generating data and allowing us to do better analytics on the cost and benefits of various courses of action, a better understanding of the performance of the process. I think if you look at, for example, some of the work that's going on in Secretary Kendall's office with the reports on the performance of the acquisition process.
Very good reports.
It's good reports, and you know, obviously we need more data, and we need to, you know, continue to work with that. But I think we're really starting to get a much better understanding of at least the effect of certain policies or certain things at least being in place and relate that to outcomes. So I think we are generating, and these capabilities are emerging, but I think we're in a place where we have perhaps the capability for understanding that were things that were unimaginable maybe even 10 or 15 years ago. So that's one thing that's different. Obviously, it would be up to us to deploy that and also for people to act on the information and be willing to, even when it goes against what people perceive as their incentives or their interests. But I think that gives us an opportunity that we have not had in the past. The second thing is, it's sort of related to that, is we have experience in trying to do some fairly significant reform or transformation of the process. I keep going back to an area that I had a lot of interaction and experience in, and that was the efforts in the 1990s that resulted in the Federal Acquisition Streamlining Act and the Clinger-Cohen bills, and then the follow-on efforts through the National Performance Review in the administration. And we aspired to some fairly ambitious things in that effort, some of which did, in fact, pan out to some extent, and others which, frankly, failed. But we have that experience. It's a fairly rich amount of information, and the folks are still around. So I think that, you know, as people, you know, there are, frankly, a lot, in a sense of no new ideas under the sun. People can say, why don't we try this or why don't we try that? Well, to the extent we've tried it in the past and it didn't work, we can either make a decision that we need to change some other factors to give it a chance, or for whatever reason it didn't work, and that's probably a good and sufficient reason for not going down that road again. So I think those two things can really inform the process this time in ways that it will be different, and whether we get a different outcome or not will depend on a lot of different factors. But I do see a convergence or an alignment somewhat, for the first time I think in a while, between Congress and then the Department of Defense, and then I think industry is sort of becoming more and more part of that conversation. So I think that at least the folks I talk to, we're starting to see this as an area of a common enterprise, because we are in a period of declining budgets, and we are not in a position, I think, where the outcomes of a lot of what we try to do are sustainable in terms of the cost, nor the system itself, perhaps. And so I think we really are under a lot of pressure to come up with a different approach in some of these areas.
Right, that is an approach that reduces transactional costs, but also ensures better outcomes,
right? Exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
The more cost-effective,
right.
More best-value
outcomes. It's got to be both.
Yeah, it can't be one or the other.
Right.
I wanted to just quickly touch on you as you appeared before the Senate Armed Services Committee as the senior fellow, as a senior fellow for the National Defense Industrial Association back in end of April.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Is this some of the kind of stuff you talked about in your testimony?
Right. In the testimony, it's a matter of record. People can read it if they have any interest in it.
It's a good read, John.
Oh, well, thank you. Those were some of the main points that I made, and I think the other areas that I think need to be taken into consideration. And again, this is some of the lessons learned from the past efforts. For example, I think we need to understand the really critical importance of what I call the boundary conditions, which really influence the behavior of the process. Things that are not totally within either the control of the acquisition world. Or things that are even outside the control of government, which definitely need to be, and I don't know if we can change those, but we certainly, as we formulate different ideas, need to account for those effects.
So can you give an example?
Yeah, sure. I think a couple things. Number one, I think the personnel system that operates in the government, both on the military and the civilian side, has a major impact on the incentives that people have, their experience, their opportunities for education, experience, training, whatever. And that has a real, I think, a huge impact on the performance of programs and the types of transactions that are successful or not. And that's something that's sort of outside the boundaries of what isn't sort of in the acquisition world. We don't have a separate process for acquisition people as opposed to the broader
people, everybody
principles.
Who gets
it's
hired
everybody,
by
right.
Yeah,
and the agencies have a lot of other different missions. So I think that's
one area I have to agree. I mean, when I was a manager in government, the HR system was the biggest challenge we faced in terms of, and it did impact mission.
Right.
You know, even if you're just working on policy stuff like I was.
Well, and I think the fact that, for example, program managers are generally members of the military, they rotate in and out of these assignments. I thought it was interesting that the most recent report from Secretary Kendall's office looked at this issue a little bit on tenure and program success and couldn't really reach any conclusions, but they didn't say it didn't matter. They just said we don't have enough information, but still an area that we need to look at. I think there's a perception that in some cases longer tenure, maybe through an entire milestone phase of a program on a major program, would have a better effect perhaps on outcomes. But those are factors. Again, that system serves a much greater purpose than the acquisition process, and yet it really drives the behavior. I think, for example, industry in their need to demonstrate shareholder value for Wall Street and some of the incentives that are out there on the financial side for them are outside really the. I mean, the government doesn't structure that environment. It's they work with companies that have to live in that larger environment. And the ability that the government has to sort of leverage that, I think, is more limited sometimes than what people think. Yet, it's those kinds of things which really drive the behaviors and the outcomes in some of these programs and some of the cost of the actual process. And so I think those things we need to have in our minds as we move forward and look at the various types of recommendations or other directions that we think people ought to follow to perhaps result in some meaningful transformation of some aspects of the process.
Okay. We got about a minute left, John, so I wanted to get your thoughts, because I think you also touched in it a little bit in your testimony, is the oversight environment. And, you know, I maintain we can make all the changes we want, streamlining the process, you know, to make, you know, create a system that reduces transactional, that could has a potential to reduce transactional costs for industry and for government, but also lead to better outcomes for both sides. All right, it's got to be a win-win or it's not going to work.
Right.
But, you know, if we don't address, you know, I think front and center the culture of the oversight culture, the way things are now, sort of gotcha, second guessing almost every decision that's made on part of management and government, second guessing or turning into judicial proceedings or investigations, what I would perceive as procurement decisions. You know, I don't think if we don't address those kind of things, I think, you know, we're having one arm tied behind our back.
I agree with that. And I also think that one of the most important areas is to look at the nature of the oversight. What is the focus? And right now it tends to be on a transaction by transaction basis. We don't look at the trade-offs in the larger space on some of the policy decisions or some of the management decisions that we may have. And I think it makes it very difficult for people in that kind of an environment to get out of a rules-based approach, because that's the safest way to do business. And that really, I think, is a large part of the culture that we're currently operating in, which that also would have to be transformed for really some of these other things to occur. And so I think part of that is understanding value, perhaps, in a clearer way, talking about it in a sense where you are looking at some of these other additional issues like time, like, you know, government overhead expense, investment, and that sort of thing. We need to have a better understanding of what value really means in government acquisition. And so I think there are and I've talked to a number of people, officials in the department, who have suggested that, and I think that's something that we really need to look at. We need to take a larger view of this, because attempting to make things that are largely tactical, they may improve things to some extent, but I don't think they're really going to position us, given the resource constraints that we're going to have, to really effectively meet the future challenges.
And lessons learned from a specific acquisition don't necessarily translate across the enterprise, right? And usually they don't.
Especially when you're looking at it as a basis of a transactional approach in a limited fashion. So we need to expand that trade space and get an appreciation for all the different factors and have that, as a matter of oversight, have that, all those things be able to be taken into a consideration.
So. Right. Well, John, thank you for once again coming on the show. Great discussion. Really enjoyed it. Again, I want to thank my guest, John Etherton of Etherton Associates, and you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.